Hello again and welcome back to I've Got a Beatles podcast, and it's Dave again with you, and we're continuing our interview with Jude Sutherland Kessler, noted Beatles and John Lennon author and historian and expert. And I hope if you haven't had a chance to go back to around early August when we had part one of the interview to kind of get a sense of what Jude's books are about and how she approaches writing. So we're going to continue now and do part two. And if the end of the first episode, we played I'll Cry Instead, because I asked Jude to come up with three songs that meant a lot to her. And the first one was Baby, It's You, and then I'll Cry Instead. But we didn't have a chance to hear why. So I'll start you there. And first, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me back. I appreciate it very much. And tell Chris I'm sorry I didn't get to meet him, that we'll have to have a big party and have all three of us on sometime.
But absolutely.
Thank you very, very much. It's an honor being here. There's a scene in volume one of the John Lennon series, which of course is a true story, about John registering for classes that first day at Liverpool College of Art. And a girl shouts at him across the registration room, "Hey, John Lennon, wasn't it you whose mother was hit by that man and killed?"
Wow.
And he goes, yeah, and tries to come up with some smart retort, is unable to think of anything, and just kind of makes a face and then walks out of the room and quickly exits the building and is leaning against the brick wall outside when Thelma Pickles joins him and says, "You know, she's horrible, that girl, and who would do that? And I know how you feel, because I lost my father as well, not through death, but through divorce. And I know how you feel, John. I know how alone you feel." So with that scene in mind, you look at the words of this song. You know, "I've got every reason on earth to be mad." He did.
Yeah.
"I've just lost the only girl I had." Now, this is pre-Cynthia. This is the girl he loves. This is Julia, the one that got away. "If I could get my way, I'd get myself locked up today, but I can't." Mm. You know, he went into his room after his mother died and locked himself up for 3 weeks. Mimi would leave the food outside the door. I mean, he wasn't bathing. He wasn't seeing anyone. He wasn't talking.
Just devastated.
Totally devastated. So he tells you, "This is John. I've got a chip on my shoulder that's bigger than my feet. I could barely stand up under the weight of it. I can't talk to people that I meet." And he couldn't. He was usually rude to people before they could hurt him. He was caustic. He did anything to keep you away from him because he was afraid that you were going to wound him. "You know, if I could see you now, Julia, I'd try to make you sad somehow because you've hurt me." And there is something of that. There is some anger in death, where you resent the person for leaving you. You know, mm-hmm. You resent that, but I can't, so I cry instead. And then, you know, you see the onslaught of Beatlemania and being surrounded by crowds. "I don't want to cry when there's people there. I get shy when they shout and stare," which he did. And it goes on telling you his life story. This is one of the most autobiographical songs that John ever pens. Hmm. If you want to know who John Lennon is, listen to this song. And oh, by the way, it's pre-Bob Dylan meeting.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so it has, meeting Bob Dylan had nothing to do with John being autobiographical. He was all of his life, even in the cover songs. We talked in the first segment about Baby, It's You, mm-hmm. being a song that told his story. This tells his story even more specifically.
How do you compare the way he is so autobiographical with the way Paul is and the way Paul writes his songs and how they got along because of the fact that they're very different? You know, I remember John made up some quip about, oh, he just writes these songs about just all kinds of funny made-up people and he just knocks these songs out. And it's hard. I still feel like to this day it's hard to know who the real Paul McCartney is.
Yeah.
How do you think they got along or reconciled that about their songwriting styles, with John being so open?
Yeah. Paul, there's a famous story about Paul as a little boy. His parents punish him, and he says to them, "You know, you're absolutely right. I was wrong. And you did exactly the right thing. I deserve this." And then he would go take a pair of scissors and snip a little bit of his mother's Irish linen curtains off.
Ooh. Nasty.
Yeah. So Paul is always outwardly congenial and Mr. PR and easy to get along with. When the Beatles hit the back of that car with the two old ladies in it when they're on tour with Johnny Gentle in Scotland, they send Paul out to go explain and to make nice with the two ladies.
The smooth talker, the good looking. Yeah.
Right. He always has the right word to say. But that doesn't mean that inside he isn't as angry as John is. I mean, but it's just kept inside, you know. And I think they both felt the same hurt and loss and anger. But there's a quote that says, the same hot water that hard boils the egg softens the carrot. Mm. So that hot water made Paul try to get along, try to be Mr. Acceptable. That hot water made John the hard-boiled egg. Mm-hmm. And they were just two different versions of the same experience. So I think they found a camaraderie in each other, even though they expressed their pain differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I don't know. Do you find that it's hard to know who he is, or you just...
You don't know.
You just don't know. Whereas I feel like Lennon, he lays it out there.
And I think that played in so well to the Paul is dead thing.
Sure. Oh, yeah. You know, that's a good point.
They could say, oh, well, he never did this before, and now he does this, and mm-hmm. this has changed, and this is different. Well, you know, you don't know.
You don't know. That's right. Yeah. Interesting.
And they were both unknowable. I mean, John was, as we talked about, from day to day, a different personality. So that's part of the mystery of it all, is that they aren't so easy to read mm-hmm. and so very obvious.
Yeah. Well, thinking about, you have to think about all this stuff when you're writing your books, of course, and how you're going to portray John. And so which book would you say has been the hardest to write and why?
Well, they're hard for different reasons. Should Have Been There, which is from his birth up to that day in December of 1961 when Brian offers them that loose managerial agreement, which in January then becomes some sort of a paper contract, which Brian never signs. That is a very difficult book to write because you don't have all the documentation.
Yeah.
One at 9 years old thought they needed to document everything about John Lennon. You know, I mean, Dickie's throwing his things away and he's saying, you're going to be sorry one of these days because I'm going to be famous and you're going to wish you had held on to all this stuff. No one is recording everything he does. So that was extremely difficult. That's when I had to travel to Liverpool 7 times to sit down with Dave Binion, the head boy, the prefect at Quarry Bank, and with the headmaster and with his teachers from Liverpool College of Art and his uncle Charlie Lennon and his best friends from school, like Helen Anderson, who could tell me about him and, you know, get to know these people and get the stories because the information isn't readily available.
No.
So that was difficult. Because I didn't have that information. Now, when you look at the books that are available, I mean, I'm stacked up with books all around me. And every time that I think I've completed a chapter, say I have 40 or 50 resources for one chapter, then I'll find one more, and then one more. And
then you have to edit and shoehorn it in there somehow. And
yeah. I spend a lot of time going back and editing things into the footnotes and changing and thinking that you know the answer to something, and then you find out it's completely different from what you thought. So that they're all difficult in their own way. I had just sent you a copy of She Loves You so that you could see the footnotes at the back. 4,000.
Yes, huge.
It's a research mania.
Mm-hmm.
And so each in its own way, I think, is very difficult, whether you have too little information or too much.
And speaking of having too much information, there, as you just said, there's so many books written about the Beatles. If you had to pick one Lennon book and one Beatles general book that really made a huge impact on you, either when you first became a Beatle fan or now doing your research, what would you say are those two books?
The Beatles book is the easiest one. It's really a Lennon and Beatles book because it's about the day that John met Paul. That's Jim O'Donnell's book.
Yeah, great.
And, there are huge books that are hundreds of pages long, and Jim O'Donnell's book is a very slim
book. Yeah.
But he captures the essence of what happened that day. He knows every detail, the weather, what the wind was doing, what the different booths were at the Woolton Garden Fete, who the princess was that day, and who what the different floats were and what order they were in. And he has researched that one topic to the hilt. Mm-hmm. And he tells it in a way that gets into your blood. You live that day. You experience that day. He tells it so that you never forget that day. And I had never written to an author ever. I'm a bookaholic.
Yeah.
And I've probably read, besides my Beatles books, 50 books since the beginning of the year. And I've never written to an author and said how much I appreciated his or her work. But I wrote to him and said, you understand Liverpool. You get Liverpool. And he called me and said, you know, why do you know so much about the Beatles and why do you know so much about Liverpool? I told him what I was doing, and he spent at least an hour on the phone with me, a total stranger, convincing me to self-publish my book and to go out and sell it. He said, I can tell from talking to you that you can do this. You don't mind stopping people on street corners and clinking your glass in restaurants, going to garden clubs and any kind of thing that'll have you and selling your book, and you can do it. So do it. And because of him, I did. So that one means quite a lot to me. It's a beautiful book. It's a great read, and it captures the essence of Liverpool.
And he actually got the date right, unlike John.
Yeah. Yeah, and every detail, right. I guess if I count that as my Lennon book, then I have to say the Beatles book would be Philip Norman Shout, because it was the first one that sort of had a narrative feel to it.
Yeah.
That's where I was going, to tell it in a way so that you would feel as if you're in the story. And he was the first one that captured the essence of what could be considered a Beatles narrative. He's a good writer in his own genre. He's not just telling you cold, hard, dry facts. He's making those facts come to life.
Did you feel that the criticism about Shout was warranted, that it was so pro-John and so anti-Paul, and that George and Ringo didn't even... As it should. Of course.
I was listening the other day to Sgt. Pepper's in the car, and I've never been a big Sgt. Pepper's fan. I'm just not. And I was listening to it, and I thought, okay, that's a Paul song. And I thought, okay, I get it now. But no. I mean, I do think that he slants toward John. There's no doubt about it. But not as much as who was it that did The Two of Us that said,
"Oh yeah,
the Beatles consisted of one giant and three midgets." Wow, that's pretty
harsh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, here's an interesting, hopefully an interesting question. Looking back at Lennon's life, we've done a couple episodes, we call them career mistake episodes, or things that we wish a Beatle had done, or that we point out things they shouldn't have done that went really bad, like Paul trying to bring in marijuana to Japan, expecting to go unnoticed. If you had to pick one or two career mistakes that John made, what would you say? It could be from the Beatles period or solo.
I think John trusted the wrong people. Mm. For all of his acerbic manner and wanting to put you off and to vet you and to see if you could really be trusted, he ended up many times trusting people who were wolves in sheep's clothing. Mm. And he said things that he should not have said to the wrong people and let things get out there. Now, Maureen Cleave was truly John's friend, and she was a trusted confidant. And so John thought he could say anything to her and that it would be fine. And you know where I'm going. So when he has that 4-hour interview with her and he talks to her in How Does a Beatle Live, about his faith and how he's struggling with faith and how Jesus is fine, but the disciples were ordinary and stupid, which many Christians today would agree with, because at many times they would ask Jesus, who are you, after they've been with him for years and years and years, and even he gets frustrated with it at points. But then he goes on, John makes his comment about being more popular than Jesus, that he needed to watch his words. He needed to be careful at times, and he would just say things. And then those things that he said would turn around and hurt him. And John never meant for that comment to be the way it turned out when it was lifted out of Maureen Cleave's interview and then put in date book out of context. And it sounded terrible.
Oh, yes.
He trusted that it would be okay. He trusted he was speaking in a safe manner. And as you know, when you speak to the press, you're never speaking in a safe manner.
Nope.
So, you know, and I could go on and talk about other people in his life that he trusted that should have, but we won't get into that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of trusting, do you think, compare Cynthia and Yoko in terms of their impact on John and what you discovered? What was something interesting that you hadn't known about either of them along the way, that either positive or negative, in terms of their influence on John? I mean, we have the narrative that generally that, you know, Cynthia was just a nice girl from Liverpool who was very supportive and didn't get in the way, compared to Yoko, who was very headstrong and an independent artist. But that seems very simplified. So,
yeah. You know, you need different people at different times in your life. Had Yoko come along when John was just starting out with the Beatles, that never would have worked.
No.
You know, he works much later in his life. When he's starting out and he says to Cynthia on their at lunch at Reese's after they've just gotten married, do you want to go with me tonight on this gig? And she says, no, I'm going to go and decorate the apartment. I'm going to move into the apartment. You go ahead. And she sets that precedent of not going with him and letting him go out on his own. At that time, that's the right precedent. That's not her being compliant and being this soft little girl. That's her being strong and saying, number one, I trust you to go on your own. Number two, I want your dreams to come true. Number three, I choose to play a role that you will need more than me being there. I've been there. She was the girl holding the microphone in the jacaranda while he sang, the microphone taped to the broomstick. She was the girl standing in the Cavern Club, watching him every night and going to get him Cokes and Nudgers. She was always there, but now she's choosing to do the braver thing, which is not be there. Cynthia is very strong. She hears all the whispered criticisms and all of the things that are going on, and she chooses to ignore them. She chooses not to act on the information she's given, but to push that aside and to love John anyway. And that's very difficult to do. But that's the role that she chooses. So she's never just a mousy little girl. She has an art degree. She was certified to be an art teacher. She designed the outside. If you go to Matthew Street today in Liverpool, the outside of Cavern Walks, all of the things that are there were designed by Cynthia. She is a very gifted artist and a poet. And, you know, she was a woman in her own right, a great mother and a great wife. But she was never that bohemian, out-of-the-box, free thinker that John was searching for, that Julia. She was never mother. She was never the older woman who would give him an allowance and send him to his room when he didn't behave. That's Yoko.
That's Enter Yoko. Yeah, exactly.
That's her role. And in 1967, 68, 69, that's what John needs. He's moving in a different direction. Now he doesn't need someone to enable his dreams. He needs someone to rein him in, to focus him and to tell him what he can and can't do and to fulfill that mother role. That's when Yoko steps in. Wouldn't have worked back in 1962, 63, 64, but it works in the later part of the 60s and the 70s.
So it's not ironic that he called Yoko mother. It wasn't just a joke. It was, serious. Yeah,
and we talked about the fact that in Julia, when he talks about Ocean Child, Julia, Ocean Child, and we all know that Yoko means Ocean Child. He talks about the seashell eyes, both Julia's and Yoko's. That's a very interwoven figure. That girl that he was always looking for, he thought he found an Astrid at one point. very bohemian, very independent, strong, artistic, talented, manifests itself in Yoko.
That's a really good point, that people come at the right time in your life, or you're always looking for different things at different times. So,
yeah.
Thinking about John Lennon now in 2016, you see him, you see Imagine posted everywhere, like little quips from the lyrics. You see the glasses, the images. He's become more of a like a figure, an icon. And
yeah.
So I think when people become that way, you sometimes lose who they are, the real story. So do you think about that with your writing and your audience? So who's reading your book? Are they these kids who, you know, high school kid who puts John Lennon on his wall because he's got his New York City pose with the peace sign, or he just thinks he looks cool, or the diehard fans? What do you think about the audience that you're writing for, especially in today's world?
Well, I've had to change what I'm doing with the book, because I thought when I started out that I was writing for those girls who went out to the airport to meet John. I thought that the readers would be all of these grown-up Beatle fan females that wanted to hear the story again. And I sell to almost no women, none.
Wow.
91 or 92% of my readership is men. I almost never, ever sell to a woman. In fact, I post many times on Twitter or Facebook, where are you, female readers? You know, none.
None.
And the other percentage that's left over, this 8 or 9% that's left over, are all millennials.
Hmm.
So, and I have some Generation X readers woven in there. But if a woman buys a book from me, it is a rare occasion.
Hmm.
And I don't know why. I don't know if they are busy with other things, and you know, men have remained the true and interested and devoted fans, or why.
Yeah.
But because of that, I changed when I started with Shivering Inside. I gave much more attention to the recording sessions, to the music, to how everything was done, and really put emphasis on that, because that's what my readers are interested in. And I never thought that would be the group. That's it.
They're not interested in just the fandom and all the sort of stereotypical things that...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, not at all.
Huh. No, no, and Shivering Inside was by far the book that sold the fastest, because it has that segment in it about the recording session in February when they did...
Please, Please Me.
And it's hour by hour and minute by minute, and all of the records from EMI or translated into that chapter, and word for word, everything they're saying is what they said off the tapes. And so that really, it sold very quickly. And same thing with She Loves You. The book's only been out a year and a half, and I think we have like 19 copies left after I sent yours.
Yeah.
But it's very heavily what went on in the studio and how the records were developed and everything. And so that's who my male readers, that's what my male readers want to read.
Well, as one of your male readers, that is the stuff that I want to read, and being a musician, too. That fascinates me, because, as they always say, it's about the music. And, yes, the story is fascinating, and how they got to that point is really fascinating. But when it comes down to it, yeah, it's the songs we like. And I think people want to know how those songs came about and what went into those songs and who were the people involved and all that stuff. So.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised to hear that, but I'm surprised to hear about the gender imbalance. That's very striking.
It's huge.
Yeah,
you know, even if it were like 60%, I would have been overwhelmed. But 91%, that's really huge. You know, I think it comes down to a question of, do you think that the life of the artist matters to the art?
Mm.
And there's a big debate there.
Oh, yeah.
If you think that art stands alone, and that music or sculpture or paintings or whatever, that work stands alone, then you're not as interested in what John said to Cynthia on the Tuesday when it rained.
Right.
You know, but if you think that what he said to her on the Tuesday when it rained changed the way he wrote his music, then that's a horse of a different color.
Yes.
So it depends on whether you know, which philosophy you stand behind.
So what, tell us about your current book that you're working on. What period, and so how's it going so far, and all that stuff?
It starts on the 2nd of March, 1964, when the Beatles show up on set to begin A Hard Day's Night and have no idea what A Hard Day's Night is going to be. Making this film and doing the interviews and going to luncheons at noon and writing a book and releasing a book and making a soundtrack.
And getting up early.
Yeah, really, it's crazy. They lived through a very, very difficult time. And then, of course, they go on that world tour. They return to the premieres in London and Liverpool of A Hard Day's Night. They go on the North American tour and on and on and on and on and never stop. So this new book is covering 64 and 65. And I am so far behind that it's not even humanly possible for someone to be. I'm almost turning inward. I'm so far behind.
No.
But anyway, I have the Fest for Beatles Fans coming up this weekend where you and I will have a great time.
Yes, looking forward to it.
I can't wait. I can't wait. And then I have Beatles at the Ridge coming up in September. And after that, no one will ever see me again.
Hibernation. Yeah.
I've done this before, you know, where I just am secluded and I work and I get it done. So the book has to come out next year. So that's it for sleeping.
Yep. Well, you just mentioned Beatles at the Ridge, which I'm very interested in hearing about. Everyone's heard of the Fest for Beatles Fans, or used to be called Beatle Fest. But tell us about Beatles at the Ridge and what you're going to be doing there and when it is and all that.
It is a free parking and free symposium and free everything. And we feed you really well at the symposium. We have coffee and cake in the morning and it's British tea with scones in the afternoon. It's a very fun day in which we have a free Beatles symposium. And Ivor Davis is our featured author. He's going to be speaking not only about his tour with the Beatles in 1964 and his memorable night when the Beatles met Elvis.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I mean, huge. But he'll be talking about the years that he spent with Muhammad Ali and how the relationship between the Beatles and Muhammad Ali changed over the years, his time with Bobby Kennedy, race relations, and how the Beatles affected race relations, because he was there the day that James Meredith entered Ole Miss. He hid out in a dorm and pretended to be a student, and they got him in to watch that event. He was the very first person to research and write about the Charles Manson murders. And he's going to talk about the supposed connection of the Beatles to the Charles Manson murders with Helter Skelter. So great, great presentation on Friday night. I'll be doing a program called Lennon's Liverpool, in which I take people through Liverpool of the 1940s and 50s and early 60s. How did the boys meet? And we're going to show some rare photos, beautiful Beatles music, and we're going to bring them all together once again. And then on Saturday morning, Sarah Schmidt is going to premiere in her book release party, her new book, Happiness is Seeing the Beatles in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking to Sarah at some point, too. So,
oh, good.
Yes, look forward to speaking with her. I'm just across the state from her in Kansas City, so I'd love to hear about what happened in St. Louis.
Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful book. I just finished it, and it's really, really good. I don't know if you've ever seen Ken Orth's collection, Meet the Lookalikes.
No.
He has 3,800 pieces of artwork that pay tribute to the Beatles, album covers that mimic the Beatles, or T-shirts, or any form of art that pays tribute to one of the Beatles' album covers.
Oh, wow.
And he's bringing that with him to exhibit. We also have the Argenta collection of photographs, which are rare photographs of the Beatles that have never been released before that are going to be available for the public to see. Aaron Ketovich is doing a lunch and learn on the comparison between the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Oh, that should be good and fiery, I'm sure.
I love it. I so love it. That's going to be really great.
Yes.
And then we're going to show the film Good Old Frida. Okay. We've been given permission by Frida Kelly to show her film, and we'll do that at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then Lena Stagg is going to do a British tea. Angie McCartney is helping out with how Paul liked his tea made. And we'll have McCartney's teas there, and we'll have live music from... There was a young man that won our talent contest at Beatles at the Ridge last year named Cameron Hicks. Mm. Extremely talented 14-year-old musician. He's our quarryman.
Wow.
So he's going to perform 45 minutes of Beatles music for us in a sing-along. All of this plus Liverpool Legends, Louise Harrison's tribute group, and tons of live bands all day long, and booths and artists. We have an artist coming from Louisiana named Lisa Hart, who has Beatles buttons from the 60s that she's made into jewelry. All kinds of Beatles.
Oh my gosh.
Free.
Free. That's unbelievable.
And September 16th and 17th.
September 16th and 17th in Walnut Ridge, Arkansas. So.
Yep, boy.
Yeah.
You're going to see things you've never seen before in your life. Last year, there was a lady, and I kid you not, with a pig on a leash, and the pig had a little kerchief on and all dolled up for Beatles.
Oh, my God.
You have to come see it.
It sounds like an event not to be missed, for sure. Yeah. A splendid time, definitely guaranteed for all.
Right.
Wow. Well, we could keep going and on, and there's just so much to talk about, and hopefully we'll get a chance to speak again, and maybe when your next book comes out, we can revisit it and see how that turned out and things you learned and if your family is still speaking to you and all of that stuff.
They won't be. I tell you, I told you before that my daughter-in-law, Carl, should have been there. Her husband's little brother.
Yes.
that's how they feel about it. So
that's how it is when you write. Yeah.
You have to. I'll see you in just a few days.
I will. I will see you in Chicago, well, in Rosemont at the Hyatt Regency. So look forward to that. And remember, September 16th and 17th at Beatles at the Ridge. And Jude's website is, once again,
JohnLennonSeries.com.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for speaking with me, and as I say, we'll do this again sometime soon, and best of luck on finishing the next installment of the John Lennon series.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you, and I look forward to meeting Chris, and thanks to all of your listeners. This has been great fun.
Well, thanks, and I'm going to end here. We're going to play Woman to finish the episode, so give me a couple words to close out the episode about Woman. What is it about that song? It's a great song, obviously one of John's great love songs. But what strikes you so much about Woman?
The line, you know your life is in, you know my life is in your hands. When I hear that, I'm like, okay, I know I have to go back to the computer and start working. So there's the guilt trip.
There you go. Thanks, John.
But it's a lovely and haunting song, one of his last and his best.
Definitely. Well, thanks again, and we will go out today with John Lennon's Woman.
Woman, I can hardly express my mixed emotions and my thoughtlessness. After all, I'm forever in your debt. And woman, I will try to